This week on The Score, what explains high housing prices across the country? Did the Trump-Kim summit help or hurt U.S. relations with North Korea? Is there a future for uranium mining in America? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. As I promised last week, The Score has more conversations from the 2019 Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC. We'll hear those later in the program. But first, a couple of weeks ago, John Dale Grover of the National Interest was a guest on The Score to talk about what he thought would happen at the second meeting of President Donald Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. This week, John comes back to analyze what actually happened. Joining us was another writer from the National Interest, Kurt Mills, who has an interesting take on National Security Advisor John Bolton. I met up with John and Kurt at the offices of the Center for National Interest in Washington on Wednesday. This morning when I woke up, I heard this report from North Korea that a missile launch facility that had been dismantled was being remantled starting to be put together again less than a week after the Hanoi summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, the North Korean strongman. What do you think that says about the summit itself, that this came to light within 7 days of the summit ending?
I think it says that North Korea is hedging. This is not surprising. There was a lot of back-channel talk when trying to set things up ahead. Ideally, you want to have a deal already set before you meet, but they didn't have one that was really set in stone. As we saw, it didn't work out. And this makes sense for them to hedge. There's been a lot of situations in the past where they wanted that capability just in case bad things happened. So they're trying to make sure that they're not caught off guard one way or the other.
I think the core reality remains North Korea is not going to denuclearize. It's a matter of gradation. If the U.S. pulls back from the negotiating table with North Korea, you're going to see an escalation in their arms race, as it were. If the U.S. returns, you're going to see reductions, but the core reality remains the North Koreans, frankly, don't have any logical incentive to fully denuclearize. They don't trust the United States, and frankly, why would they?
We're in the offices of the Center for the National Interest, publishers of the National Interest, which I guess you would describe as a conservative, neoconservative, realist journal.
Realist publication.
Those of us who studied international affairs in college know that that's a school of thought. A return guest to The Score is John Dale Grover, who's the assistant managing editor, and Kurt Mills, who is a writer on international affairs.
Yeah, I cover the State Department and the National Security Council.
A couple weeks ago, John, we talked about the upcoming North Korea summit. Did your predictions come true, or were they coming short of what you expected?
My predictions fell short. I was being a bit more optimistic than events ended up calling for. That being said, the door to diplomacy is still open, and I think that the most important takeaway is that neither side left screaming and kicking and immediately escalating. Although, yes, they are rebuilding that satellite launch site, yes, we have different narratives about why the summit fell apart. The important thing is no one immediately would turn to fire and fury, and that's the most important thing, and hopefully not going back to that anytime soon.
What did you think was going to happen?
I think what did happen is classic Donald Trump, which is the New York real estate wheeler dealer. I think he's taking sort of small deal negotiation strategy to the international stage in a way that's never really been tried before. I greatly anticipate another summit, unless relations deteriorate to such a point that it's a non-starter in this first term.
One of the things that we talked about in our last conversation, John, was that the previous summit in Singapore was kind of done on the fly without any preparations that you normally associate with a high-level meeting of two heads of state. But that this summit in Hanoi had a lot of preparations, and there were documents that were set to be signed, ceremonially. And yet, even with that preparation, this one fell apart. Going back to what you were saying about this being classic Donald Trump, does he accept what his team does for him, or does he undermine it?
Draw your own conclusions. I would say, in general, if the goal is peace between North Korea and the United States, broadly speaking, I think structure is not always a guarantor of some sort of agreement. And I'll give this example. During the Obama administration, a lot of the hang-up between getting the two sides, Washington and Pyongyang, to the table is that the Obama administration was very much committed to what was known as the P5+1 framework, which is the UNSC countries plus the North Koreans, China, Russia, France, et cetera, the Brits. And that framework is more complicated. It's way harder to get six people to the table, or six parties to the table, than two, or seven parties to two. And so I would say that, to Trump's credit, in my view, the first summit in Singapore happened because he was just willing to meet Kim Jong-un man-to-man. And there actually was some concessions on both sides. Now that you have a greater part of the national security bureaucracy involved, especially with Trump, who is, by all rights, an amateur president in foreign affairs, there is the greater potential for hiccups. I think most notably, square at the table in Hanoi was the national security advisor, John Bolton, who I don't think is necessarily committed to sabotage of these negotiations. He's certainly way more committed to a harder line than Trump is. Bolton not only wants denuclearization, which we talked about, which I think is a fantasy, frankly, he also wants the eradication of the North's biological and chemical weapons stockpiles. Again, I think that's just a much bigger ask than already an enormous ask.
John?
Absolutely. And if you consider that previous negotiation, say, for instance, the Iran deal, that took 2 years to work out. And they didn't even have a working nuclear weapon at that point. They still don't. But it's one of those situations where it takes a long time to work this out. And normally there's a lot of lower-level talks and mid-level talks. And to Trump's credit, there was a lot more of that this time around. But it was insufficient. And part of that is the reports coming out of the South Korean media that John Bolton did go there, and he did convince Trump to increase the demands that were being made. It's one thing to talk about nuclear. It's, as Kurt said, it's very different to talk about biological and chemical on top of that. And again, as I said, the door remains open. And one thing to talk about with the reports that are going on now about the North Koreans rebuilding the testing facility is that this is a satellite testing facility, which is not the same thing as a missile testing facility, although there's technical similarities. So they've used satellite launches as a way to get around international sanctions before by saying, oh, it's a satellite launch when it's very similar technology to missiles. So, this is a concern, but it's not the same thing as if they were doing other kinds of preparations.
Well, we should remember that the missile gap began with the launch of Sputnik, which was a satellite. But getting back to what you were saying about fantasies and John Bolton, Kurt, Bolton is the focus of an article you have currently online with the National Interest. Fantasies is Donald Trump's view of North Korea as being an economic powerhouse and a tourist attraction with beach mm-hmm. condominiums. Let's talk about Bolton. He's been the focus of a number of articles in the past few days and how he operates his modus operandi as national security advisor and how he tries to channel foreign policy in the Trump administration, which, as we've discussed, is rather chaotic in the way it runs.
Right. So everybody knows that Donald Trump is not an ordinary Republican, and in a lot of ways he's reshaping the Republican Party in his image. I think it's clear that there are a lot of voters who agree with basically Trump's set of values and preferences. There are not that many members, if any, of the elite apparatus in this city and in the country writ large who agree with Trump's goals. Accordingly, most of these career professionals have refused to work for this president, especially after the sort of first wave of firings in the first 2 years that we saw. I think if you had to compare two officials in the administration, you would compare Bolton and the former Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. Trump takes a foreign policy course that the pullout of Syria and the partial drawdown of Afghanistan. Mattis disagrees with it. He resigns in moral protest. Bolton says publicly he agrees with it. And, I mean, if you believe NBC News yesterday, has basically all but scuttled the Syria withdrawal. It's two different approaches. Bolton is public respect and obsequiousness to the president, while behind the scenes, knife fighting and crafting the administration's policy in his own image. Look, I don't think Bolton is getting – this isn't the Bolton presidency per se. He's not getting everything he wants. A John Bolton presidency might not even see us at the table in Hanoi. However, this is the most powerful national security advisor of my lifetime, certainly.
I saw John Bolton speak at the Heritage Foundation a few months ago on Africa policy, which is my professional portfolio. And regardless of whether you agree or disagree with him on policy issues, he's got a tremendous grasp of the set of knowledge that you need to formulate foreign policy. I mean, he gets in the weeds, and he knows his stuff. And I think that has an effect on how he runs the National Security Council. And as I recall from the Washington Post article, he tends not to consult with his assistant directors and such.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't – although he was a Fox News contributor, and he can do the TV kind of game, this isn't some kind of right-wing shock jock. He's deeply conservative. He's deeply partisan. He's a believer in this stuff, but he's an expert. Okay, he's in some ways emerging as in the national security space, similar to the role that Dick Cheney had in the early part of the Bush administration, where you have Bush was before 9/11 ran on, you could say, like a realist foreign policy. Cheney, of course, after the crisis, is able to channel and the energy of the whole national security bureaucracy in a certain way. I have information that Bolton was on the Hill today. Bolton has traveled more than most national security advisors ever have. It's similar to almost to like a Kissinger role, Henry Kissinger role. Very unusual for the NSA to be traveling as much as more as the Secretary of State. I think you see Bolton in basically all the halls of power in Washington germane to his issue set. And, again, that could be a risk for him. Trump, vis-a-vis other people who have sort of taken the limelight, like Mr. Steve Bannon for something like that, eventually gets rid of those people. Bush, to his own case, eventually diminished Cheney's role out of concern or jealousy, if you like. But for now, 2019, March, you're talking about the most powerful person in American national security is John Bolton.
How do you view that? We're getting a little far afield from North Korea, but I think that this all fits into sort of the jigsaw puzzle that is the Trump administration. Do you agree, disagree with what Kurt was just saying?
No, I pretty much agree. Exactly. I was thinking about Cheney as well, and he is incredibly powerful. He's, as he said, a bureaucratic knife fighter. He knows his way in and out of the system to get things done and move things along in a way that many other people just don't have that kind of knowledge. I think that he's going to continue to have an influence until he, gets against Trump in the wrong way. And that's something to be concerned about, not just with North Korea, but any other crises that Bolton has a much more hawkish approach on.
Yeah, we only have about 45 seconds left, so I'd like each of you to sort of summarize where you think U.S. policy toward North Korea and North Korea policy toward the United States is going to be in 6 months or a year. Kurt, you go first.
Status quo.
Same, as long as no one resorts to fire and fury or threats to escalation.
That was a nice, brief response to a very open-ended question. John Dale Grover, Kurt Mills, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I really appreciate your time today and your insights. Thank you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
The Center of the American Experiment is a think tank based in Minnesota and focused on that state's public policy environment. When I was at CPAC last week, I had a chance to speak with the organization's president, John Hinderacher. He told me about the center's mission and some of its recent accomplishments. From CPAC 2019, here's John Hinderacher.
I'm John Hinderacher, and I am the president of Center of the American Experiment, a policy organization headquartered in Minnesota.
And what does the Center of the American Experiment do?
Well, we are a policy organization like quite a few others around the country. We produce research papers, we hold public events, bring in speakers. We're a little different, though, from what people think of as a traditional think tank because of our populist approach. We try very hard to reach everyone in our state of Minnesota and around the country as well, but focused primarily on Minnesota. Every year, we have tens of millions of contacts with people in our state on the radio, through TV ads, through billboards. I think we might be the only think tank that puts up billboards. It's a medium that we love. Millions of people see our billboards. And, you know, we're very active in social media. And so we use every medium available to try to communicate with the largest possible number of people and bring them a conservative perspective on issues of the day. What we're trying to do, obviously, is to change the civic culture in our state and swing it in a more conservative direction.
And how long have you been going?
Well, the organization, Center of the American Experiment, has been around for about 29 years. It was founded by Mitch Perlstein. I took over the organization 3 years ago after retiring from a career in the law business. And so I'm relatively new to the think tank world, but we have made huge strides just in the last few years and have really inaugurated this very activist approach as a policy organization. We're hoping that other organizations around the country will follow our lead.
Well, tell me about some of the issues that you deal with and how you advocate for them.
Sure. So a lot of the things that we do relate in one way or another to Minnesota's economy. Every year we put out a big report on the state of Minnesota's economy, which isn't very good. In our state, there's this mythology, you know, about how great we do, and our unemployment rate is low, and we have big companies headquartered in our state, and there's a real misconception about our economic growth, which is actually rather sluggish, about our job growth, which is below average, about our productivity, which shockingly is well below the national average. And so we got a big job to do to alert Minnesotans to the fact that if we want to do better, we have to have different policies. We can't be one of the highest tax states in the country and think we're going to attract entrepreneurs. We can't think we're going to have an excellent GDP growth rate when we have the third highest corporate income tax in America and the lowest personal income tax rate that we have, the lowest rate, 5.35%. is higher than the highest rate in 23 states. We're uncompetitive. And so we use all media to get that kind of message in front of Minnesota voters. An example of a huge campaign we ran last year is mining. Minnesota is home to the largest undeveloped mineral deposits in the world, well over $1 trillion in non-ferrous minerals lying completely undisturbed because of ill-founded extreme environmentalist objections. So we produced a major paper, over half of which was about the environment. We retained one of the top mining environmental experts in the world to write that part of the paper for us. And we found, we have an economist on staff, and we found that developing even a small part of these mineral resources would add $3.7 billion a year to the state's economy and create 8,500 high-quality jobs. So we created a TV ad that we played all over the state. We created a longer version of that ad that got hundreds of thousands of views on the internet as a YouTube pre-roll. We had radio ads all over the state. We put billboards up all over Minnesota. Mining plus environment equals a stronger Minnesota. That was the language. Beautiful, beautiful graphics. We held public meetings in the northern part of the state. And we drove it. We made mining an issue where it had not been an issue before, and it's had a profound impact on the state. So that's an example of the kind of campaign that we do.
And certainly Minnesota is known for its iron ore. What are some of the non-ferrous minerals? Does that include rare earths?
Well, no, not, people have not been focusing on rare earths, but what we have in abundance is copper, nickel, cobalt, titanium, things like that.
And those are all important for the modern telecommunications economy.
They're incredibly important. I mean, people talk about, you know, the green economy and so on. Well, that's a whole other story. But you can't have any of that stuff. You can't have a cell phone, you can't have a laptop without cobalt. And we import most of our cobalt from the Congo, where a lot of it is mined by child labor with no environmental protections whatsoever. Minnesota has the majority of the cobalt in the United States, and we aren't touching it.
So, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have these enormous mineral resources completely untouched. Copper. You want to drive an electric car? Well, you better be willing to mine a whole lot of copper, because every car has got, I forget the number exactly, but quite a lot of copper. But electric vehicles have got an order of magnitude more copper, an enormous amount. So these are minerals that we desperately need, that we're going to use, and if we don't mine them and make the money off mining them, somebody else will. Somebody else is. And often those somebody else's are countries that we shouldn't be relying on. It's not smart from a security standpoint for us to be reliant on the Democratic Republic of Congo for minerals that are vital to our national security.
Well, and as a matter of fact, at the end of 2017, the president issued an executive order on the national security ramifications of minerals.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is an issue that shouldn't be political, because we're talking about great jobs, we're talking about national security, we're talking about a huge boost to the state's economy and the nation's economy. But the Obama administration, in its last days, issued an order that would take northern Minnesota, virtually the entire mineral-producing region, off limits for exploration and development. And they thought that he wanted to do the dirty work before Hillary Clinton came in, so she wouldn't take the heat for it. Well, of course, to the dismay of the Democrats, Hillary didn't win. And in the early months of the Trump administration, they revoked that order. So that, at the federal level, does make northern Minnesota available for exploration and development, but we need the cooperation at the state level, and that's where we come in. And I'm happy to say that the first non-ferrous project in Minnesota has now been permitted after 14 years of administrative process. And we're hopeful that more is on the way.
So do you suppose that your educational efforts had a role in that, in certainly in influencing state government officials?
Well, you know, I would never publicly claim that. You know, regulators do what they think is right. But there's no question about the fact that that my organization, Center of the American Experiment, made mining into a major issue all over the state of Minnesota, strongly made the case that all of the environmental hurdles are easily jumped over, and that we are leaving an enormous amount of economic gain on the table and not developing these resources. And around our state, I think everybody credits us with helping to move the process forward.
Well, now that you've worked on the minerals and mining issue, what other issues might you be working on?
Oh, gosh, you know, we work on taxes all the time. You know, we're in favor of restraining spending. At the state level, you can't print money, right? So if you want to cut taxes, you got to restrain your spending. So, you know, we testify in the legislature all the time talking about spending restraint and tax cuts. On the cover, we have a quarterly magazine called Thinking Minnesota with a circulation of 80,000. Pretty impressive. And to my knowledge, there's no policy organization in the country that has anything like it. It's graphically very sharp, as you can see. It's a fun magazine to read. And the cover story in the current issue of Thinking Minnesota is on beer. Uh-huh. And it's about, this is a kind of a lesson in economics, a lesson in basic conservative principles. The craft brewing industry is booming in Minnesota, as it is in a lot of other states. Why is that? Well, it's being driven by reduction in regulations and taxes that were making it very difficult for small brewers to start up. And now that taxes have been cut and regulations have been lessened, guess what? You walk into a liquor store, you can't even count all the local beers, all the different varieties. And so it's a good lesson in how when you cut back on too much government, what you get is a lot more consumer service. You get more variety, you get better products. So it's a very fun story to have on the cover of our magazine. And I've noticed that a lot of young people who stop by our booth here at CPAC are picking up a copy of that issue of Thinking Minnesota.
Well, that's great. I appreciate your time today, and I wish you good luck here at CPAC.
Thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
When The Score returns, we'll talk to economist Emily Hamilton about housing prices and what drives them upward, and a CPAC participant will tell us about the benefits of uranium mining in the United States. The Score will be right back, so don't wander far from your radio speakers.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. Everybody has to live somewhere, but housing prices often put a crunch on people, especially middle-income earners in vibrant economic zones. I met with economist Emily Hamilton, a returned visitor to The Score, at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I asked her about the economic and regulatory forces that affect the price of housing. We talked on Wednesday in the Mercatus broadcast studio in Arlington, Virginia.
There's a sort of irony in the fact that in cities and regions of the country that have a vibrant economy where there's a lot of job growth and salaries are increasing, the housing market seems to shut out middle-income people. If you're poor or working class, you can get subsidized housing through government assistance. Or if you're rich, you know, you can get luxury housing, which seems to be what builders are building. Whereas in the rest of the country where there's not as much job growth and salaries seem to be stagnant, there's plenty of housing for middle-income people. What explains this phenomenon?
That's a great question. And as you said, it's a huge irony. The places with the best job opportunities in the country aren't growing because land use regulations stand in the way of expanding the housing supply overall, and particularly less expensive types of new housing that aren't just luxury condos. And the burden falls on middle-income people, as you say, but also any low-income people who aren't qualifying for those government subsidies are the most hurt by the current situation.
We're in the studio at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I'm talking to Emily Hamilton, who's an economist who specializes in housing and land use policy. Housing prices vary a lot around the country. Is there a difference in the way the economy works for rental prices as opposed to mortgage prices or the price of home ownership?
Yes, the ratio of house prices to rental rates varies quite a bit across the country. And it tends to be that in those most expensive markets, that ratio is higher. So while rent prices in, say, San Francisco are extremely high, house prices are just off the charts. And that's because people are who are buying houses in these very expensive markets expect that prices are going to keep going up and up. So they're paying for shelter when they buy a house, but they're also paying for the expectation that this house is going to appreciate a lot.
I live in a college town, Charlottesville, and I've heard numerous stories of parents of students at the University of Virginia who will buy a condo, hold on to it for 4 years, let their kids live in it rent-free, and then sell it without making any improvements for a profit. Is this something that happens around the country, especially in other college towns?
Definitely. Yeah, it's not just these coastal cities that are centers of very high-paying jobs that are experiencing high and rising prices. It's also college towns, resort towns, and increasingly cities in the Mountain West.
And what are the policies that lead to higher housing prices? I know a lot of it is involved in zoning, building codes. Can you expand on that a bit?
That's right. It's primarily zoning, rules that limit the density of housing that's allowed to be built, rules that mandate that new development can only be single-family homes in large parts of cities rather than more affordable housing typologies. And to your question about why the market isn't serving middle-income people well, one reason is that in many markets, it's difficult to build what's often called missing middle housing. These are townhomes, small apartment buildings that have, say, 4 to 12 units in them, and housing like duplexes and triplexes that are illegal to build in single-family zoned areas. But they're often not profitable to build in the areas where high-rise housing is allowed. So that type of housing is often just shut out of markets entirely.
So in places where you could have an 8-story building with 24 units, it makes economic sense for a builder to put that building up, but it doesn't make sense for them to put 24 duplexes or triplexes that would be affordable for a young family, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah, in these places where land values are very high, developers need to take advantage of that often with high-rise construction, but that does tend to be a more expensive type of construction combined with more expensive land costs creates an expensive final product.
Are there any places in the country, cities or counties, that have reformed their zoning laws to improve the housing economy?
Yes. So the situation, is in many ways terrible right now. Housing prices are high and burdensome for many households across the country. But the good news is that it's an area with lots of reform activity. Perhaps the most exciting recent reform is in Minneapolis. The city council adopted a new comprehensive plan that allows up to triplexes in all parts of the city that were formerly zoned as single family. So effectively allowing triple the number of households to live in those neighborhoods. There have also been reforms in cities from Atlanta to Seattle, and there's increasingly activity at the state level. California has been the leader in state-level reform because they have 4 very expensive housing markets, and the households in the state are in crisis due to house prices. A couple of years ago, California passed a reform that allows accessory dwelling units or backyard cottages,
like a mother-in-law unit,
exactly, to be built in all lots that have single-family homes. They're also looking at stronger legislation that would limit how much localities can restrict housing development near transit stations. So the state is putting tons of money into transit, including building rail stations that are very expensive to serve California cities. But in some cases, localities have zoned the area around these expensive investments to only allow single-family housing or low-density retail that isn't taking advantage of that investment.
You may not have studied this in particular, but you know, people of my parents' generation were able to buy their first home when they were in their early 20s. But now with the student loan burdens, young 20-somethings or even 30-somethings aren't able to afford to get a mortgage and invest in housing as they're building their families. What's the connection between those two things, if any?
Yeah, this is outside of my direct area of study, but it's certainly true that as people are burdened by housing costs, if they're not able to afford a mortgage, households are likely spending a large portion of their paycheck on rent each month. So that's setting back their progress on perhaps paying down their student loans or saving for longer-term goals.
What other aspects of public policy affect the availability of housing at any price around the country? We've talked about zoning. I've heard you talk about building codes, and maybe that's something that our listeners might be particularly interested in. I assume that has to do with plumbing and the kinds of nails used, the kinds of windows. What are some building code burdens that prevent the building of affordable housing at any price?
Great question. Building codes are an area of increasing academic research. I think people have shied away from suggesting any building code reform because, of course, no one wants to suggest a change to building codes that will endanger residents. But there are rules that can reduce construction costs without putting people in danger. So, for example, some cities like Philadelphia require metal pipes still, even though plastic pipes are much cheaper. Metal pipes are preferred by some in the trade, and so they've kept that requirement on the books, driving up house prices. There are also examples of requiring exit stairs to be built a certain way that may take up more space within high-rise buildings, whereas if these stairs are allowed to be built so that multiple exits intertwine, they can take up less space in the core of a building while still providing the same level of safety.
And I don't know whether this is still true, but I know for many years, generations perhaps, in New York City it was illegal to have a garbage disposal, which led to a lot of illegal garbage disposals in the city. Are there quirky regulations like that that make housing more difficult to create?
Well, it's certainly true that when house prices become untenable because of regulations that are on the books, people go underground by perhaps creating illegal basement apartments or leasing units that don't have a kitchen, leading residents to use things like hot plates that can be more dangerous. So regulations that limit legal housing can contribute to illegal housing that's unregulated, off the books, and often less safe than what would otherwise be built.
Well, I can give you an example. A colleague of mine who lives outside of Philadelphia in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, he had an in-law unit on his land. An old farmhouse is the main building, converted a chicken coop into two apartments. The local zoning people came along and said, you can have a living room and the bathroom, but you can't have a kitchen. You're not allowed to have a stove or a refrigerator in this building. And that just seemed absurd.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for cities to put limits on the number of stoves that can be on a single lot to reduce turning single-family homes into homes for multiple families.
Just before we have to go off the air, we have maybe 45 seconds left. Are you aware of any reforms in the state of Virginia that are notable or proposed?
Virginia recently made a change to its proper system that allows developers to negotiate with municipalities about the proffer or the benefit that the developer will provide to the jurisdiction and the neighbors of a new property. And this reform also allows the proffer to be off-site. So previously, developers could only provide, say, public space that's located directly on the lot where the new building will be. I have mixed feelings about this reform, but I do think it's possible that expanding the proffer system will provide a little grease to help properties, to help new developments make it through the approval process in Virginia.
Yeah, that certainly seems to create some more flexibility in the construction process.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Emily Hamilton, I appreciate your comments today. Everybody needs a place to live, so it's important to know how the housing market works. And I hope we'll come back and talk to you again sometime on similar issues.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
As environmental activists urge us to seek alternatives to fossil fuels in an effort to slow down global climate change, one option often overlooked is expanding nuclear energy to produce electricity. Scott Melby is Executive Vice President of the Uranium Energy Corporation. He was at CPAC to promote uranium mining in the United States, which, he argues, would have benefits both for energy users and for national security. Here's Scott Melby.
Hi, Rick. I'm Scott Melby. I'm with Uranium Energy Corp. We're a Texas-based uranium producer, and we're here at CPAC to raise awareness around the growing overdependence on foreign uranium that we're realizing here in the United States, both for electricity generation, but perhaps even more importantly for our military needs, the fuel that keeps our aircraft carriers and submarines operating.
I expand on that a bit. How much is the United States dependent on foreign sources of uranium?
Well, that's a great question, and it's really at the heart of the issue. We, despite abundant resources in the western United States, we are now importing 98% of the fuel needed to run the reactors that are 20% of our electricity. We're for a global, vibrant, competitive fuel cycle, but now 40% of those supplies are coming from Russia and Kazakhstan, and China is rising not far behind them. So we don't want to find ourselves in a situation like Germany, where they're now beholden to Russia because of their gas supplies. With the U.S., we have the resources, people, technologies. We shouldn't be in the same position.
And uranium is important for green energy development. We need more nuclear energy if we want to stop reliance on fossil fuels.
Absolutely. Nuclear energy in the United States is our largest source of carbon-free electricity. It's 60% of our carbon-free energy, and it's baseload 24/7. It doesn't just run when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. So it's important that, in the United States, we should have a mix of energy sources, and renewables clearly has a place in that mix, but it's not baseload 24/7 power, and nuclear can provide that, but also provide the clean air benefits.
What are the obstacles to increasing production domestically of uranium and related minerals?
Sure. Well, the big headwind we have, and we have had over the last 7-8 years, is we've obviously had a challenging market after the Fukushima events, that disaster in 2011. But we have seen the demand for uranium globally now increase to a place where it's greater than it was prior to Fukushima. So demand is not really the problem. Where we're seeing pressure in the market is this dumping of state-owned uranium in the United States. Producers in Russia and Kazakhstan aren't held to the same market drivers that we are, same environmental standards. And so they've been pumping out more and more uranium below the global sort of production cost of uranium. And so that's a major headwind because we are competitive. Mines in the U.S. that are well run can be in the lower half of global production cost. So we can make a very significant contribution like we have in the past. In the U.S., 1980, we were the world's largest uranium producer, certainly supplying most of our domestic needs, to a point now where Kazakhstan is the largest and we're only supplying 2% of our needs.
And where will new deposits of uranium in the United States come from?
Yeah, so the main areas, the largest deposits that are being mined and will be mined are out in the western United States in Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Nebraska, and Texas. There's a number of plants in that have been constructed or are in development that can meet this increased demand. There's also a deposit in your state of Virginia, which hasn't been developed, but we don't lack resources in the United States, and we can mine using very environmentally friendly technologies like the in-situ recovery method, which allows us to go mine deposits in sandstone-hosted formations that can be done with minimal impact on the environment. So potential.
You mentioned Virginia, which has a legal moratorium on uranium mining, I think for the past 40 years.
Right.
Are there other states with those kinds of legal obstacles?
I think Virginia is extreme in that regard. We generally, we're regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with some input from the EPA. But more and more states are becoming what's known as agreement states. Wyoming and Texas are two such examples where they regulate uranium mining to the federal standard, but it's managed out of their state regulatory body. So they're more responsive. They have nobody has a greater vested interest than the state itself. And so we find that states that have gone to that model are it's not easy to license a new mine, and it shouldn't be easy. We should have to meet all the most stringent environmental standards, and we do. But we find that agreement state structure is very positive. High regulatory standards, but administered at the state level.
Do you foresee it becoming easier to build nuclear power plants in the next few years?
Yeah, it's interesting, and there's been a lot of perhaps one of the only benefits of the Green New Deal, which was a little short on science and economics behind some of the things proposed there. But we are seeing a renewed discussion and acceptance of nuclear power from, of all places, the climate change community, where they've been doing this now for 24 years and have seen very little progress on carbon emissions reductions, excuse me. And, they're now kind of coming to this realization, if we are going to make any impact, not only in countries like Germany, that have been trying for 24 years and not succeeding, what about countries like India and China that are emerging markets and, they've got to deliver electricity in a way that doesn't harm the environment, the clean air, and forget about climate change, just pollution issues in those countries are first and foremost. So it is a very exciting time for nuclear. We've added 37 reactors in the last 5 years, 50 more in construction. So
and that's globally.
Yes, yeah.
Well, just one last question for our listeners. Where can they find out more information about this issue?
I would direct you to uraniumenergy.com. Is our website, or if you want more information on the this 232 petition that the Commerce Department's currently looking at to investigate the level of foreign uranium imports and some remedies, you can go to domesticuranium.org. Is kind of a website that really specifically addresses that issue. So,
well, thank you for the information. Thank you for your comments today. I appreciate you being here at CPAC.
Great, thank you.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit bearingdrift.com.
While we're talking about energy, we should look at coal, too. When I was at CPAC, I was introduced as Chris Skates, an advisor to Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin. Although I thought he was whistling past the graveyard, he made an enthusiastic case for coal's comeback after years of decline. Listen to his arguments and decide for yourself if he's on the right track.
I'm Chris Skates. I'm just here as a private citizen, but in my full-time job, I'm an advisor to Governor Bevin. And Governor Bevin is going to be chairman of the Southern States Energy Board this year. He is chairman. He came in September. And one of the things we do is we look at policy recommendations for the president and the Department of Energy as it relates to growing the energy sector.
Well, what's the future of the energy sector in the way you're looking at it?
Much like what Craig said in his interview, I see a very distinct and robust coal bridge to a nuclear future. I don't think renewables are the answer, not even close. The numbers don't bear it out. Again, not even close. I know that that's the popular mantra of the day, that renewables are some kind of answer for the future. They're not. But the modular, as I would call it, cookie cutter nuclear reactor, advanced reactor technology, we learned a lot in the 70s and 80s about how to do nuclear really well. I think that can work. But in the interim, we need to keep our coal plants viable. We've shut down 23,000 megawatts of coal-fired power in this country in the last 5 years, largely because of the Obama administration's war on coal, which was a real thing. And that trend still hasn't completely stopped. President Trump slowed it down a lot, but the mechanism of that was already in place, and a lot of these older coal plants have died the death of 1,000 green cuts. So they're having to shut down some of these plants just because of the profitability. Now, natural gas prices are low right now. That's part of the equation, too. But we can't eliminate the effect that environmental policy had on them, environmental regulations. The Trump administration, the Trump EPA, the Trump Department of Energy gets it, and they're trying to do a lot to help the coal plants, but it's going to be slow turning that big battleship. So we've got to make sure that we don't prematurely shut down too many of these coal plants.
But as you said, natural gas is cheaper than coal.
Yeah.
So isn't it really market forces that are driving utilities away from using coal?
I wouldn't disagree. Market forces are probably 60% of the equation, but they're not 100%. Mm-hmm. That's still a big 40%. So to the extent that we can help with the 40% and be practical, doesn't mean we have to go back to the 60s and pump out black smoke. Nobody's going to go back to that. Nobody wants to go back to that. But we can. There's a lot of the regulations that were done in the really through the 90s and 2000s that were just excessive, and are not really benefiting the environment. So we need to look at some of those. The natural gas prices are a big part of the equation, but natural gas supplies can be interrupted. There's one giant pipeline that fuels almost the eastern half of the United States. If anything ever happened to that pipeline, God forbid, a terror attack, anything. Then we're going to have a big interruption in gas. The polar vortex 2 weeks ago, there were several states that told their gas customers, lower your thermostats to 55 degrees. Make up the rest with electric space heaters. Well, where do you think that electricity came from? Coal-fired power plants. So we've been spoiled because the coal plants have been handling what's called the base load for so long that we can afford to take all these gambles with wind power, solar power, highly subsidized. We can play all those games because the coal plants are there. But if we're closing these coal plants, once they're gone, they're gone. We're not going to be able to build new, robust coal plants. And that's another thing, if I could just mention. Gas plants are notoriously not as robust as coal plants. Coal plants are like your grandpa's reliable old Chevy pickup. You wouldn't be afraid to get it out and start it up and drive it to Miami. Gas plants are like a Miata. They're quick and they can ramp up and ramp down really fast and they can respond really fast, but they don't have that durability. So that's something we don't need to do away with until we've got something to replace them with, which we don't.
If the alternatives were coal and nuclear energy, which would you choose?
In the near term, it would almost have to be coal because we're 10 years away from ramping up the nuclear production to where it could meet the need. In the short term, coal. In the long term, I do think nuclear is a very viable answer.
And there's also the mix of solar and wind and tides that we've been talking about for 40 years or longer.
Yeah.
But the technology is there. It's just whether it can be marketable.
That would be my argument. The minute that wind and nuclear can compete in the market and not create a blight on the landscape, I hate the way windmills look when I'm driving through the Midwest, then I'll be all for them. Right now they can't do that, so I don't think they deserve a seat at the table.
Well, I appreciate your comments today. It's always good to learn about technology, and energy is our future. It's what makes our economy
Absolutely.
Run.
Okay, but thank you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
That's all the time we have for The Score this week. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. The Score will be back next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends where to find us, and join in the conversation by leaving comments on BearingDrift.com. We'll be waiting for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.